This is number 2 for the course Management and Leadership Theory. Let's now notice some of the studies of leadership and management theory that have been undertaken and some of the principles that have been drawn from these various studies. Perhaps we should mention that one of the earliest approaches to leadership study was the trait, that's T-R-A-I-T, the trait approach. The assumption was that some persons are natural leaders. They are endowed with certain traits not possessed by other individuals, and it was actually these traits that would produce leadership within them. The early leadership researchers were not sure exactly what traits would be essential for leadership effectiveness, but they were confident that these traits could be identified by empirical research. This research was enhanced by the psychological testing that was done between 1920 and 1950. These various studies considered physical characteristics, psychological makeup, for example, such as personality, and specific abilities. One of the approaches used was to compare non-leaders with leaders and also successful leaders with less successful leaders. Some of the information and findings came from Stockdale's 1948 review. He considered 124 trait studies, which were done between 1904 and 1948. His research seemed to indicate a number of traits that seemed to differentiate leaders from non-leaders. Some of these were intelligence, alertness to others' needs, intuition, persistence in dealing with problems, self-confidence, and the acceptance of responsibility. However, Stockdale found that results differed dramatically from situation to situation. I believe that's one of the key discoveries, one of the key realities as we would consider leadership and what makes a person a leader. That he found, as many other researchers have discovered, that there was a difference from situation to situation. So I think we would have to say that even in this early study, that the situational aspect of leadership was found to be very important. Stockdale concluded that the expectations and goals of the followers had to be included in the leadership formula. Hundreds of studies were done during the 1930s and the 1940s, but no solid evidence was found to prove that any trait automatically assured success in leadership. Stockdale wrote, "A person does not become a leader by virtue of the possession of some combination of traits. The pattern of personal characteristics of the leader must bear some relevant relationship to the characteristics, activities, and goals of the followers." In effect, these early studies failed to support the basic premise of the trait approach. In 1974, Stockdale did another review. We will summarize it at this point. For 1974, Stockdale did another review. His 1948 research had greatly discouraged the trait approach to the understanding of leadership. However, another side of the coin emerged with the work of industrial psychologists who began to work in the area of managerial sciences. These studies looked not so much as the personality or natural characteristics, at that point acquired characteristics, but those abilities that one could develop through training and experience. They were looking at administrative and technical skills, such as adaptability to situations, alertness to social environment, ambition, achievement, assertiveness, cooperativeness, decisiveness, dependability, dominance, energetic approach to problems, persistence, self-confidence, toleration of stress, and even a willingness to assume responsibility. Again, the emphasis was upon those skills and characteristics that could be studied, learned, mastered, and applied in managerial leadership situations. rather than some list of natural traits acquired at conception which automatically assured success as a leader. So now there was a different approach. There seemed to be more of an understanding that one is a leader not necessarily because he is born with trait A, trait B, and trait C, but you must put into that formula the situation and the circumstances in which this individual is going to lead, as well as the group that this individual is going to lead. I think it's interesting for us to note that people have never asked us, can management be taught? Are managers born or made? These questions are always raised, though, about leadership, but never about management. It's a curious phenomenon. Why should management be viewed as a set of skills and abilities, but leadership be viewed as a set of innate personality characteristics? We have simply assumed that management can be taught, and on the basis of that assumption, we've established hundreds of business schools and companies have educated hundreds of thousands of managers. Certainly, some of those managers are better and some are worse than others. But in general, schools have probably raised the caliber of managers by assuming that people can learn the abilities, skills, and knowledge associated with good management practice. The same can be done with leadership. By viewing leadership as a non-learnable set of character traits, a self-fulfilling prophecy has been created that dooms societies to having only a few good leaders. If you assume that leadership is learnable, you will be surprised to discover how many good leaders there really are. Modern research seems to indicate that there are certain traits that would increase the likelihood that one could function as a leader, but these traits do not assure success. Let me underscore that again. These traits do not assure success. There are other variables that must be added. And it also must be remembered that what traits are needed in what situation will vary from situation to situation and from group to group. Andrew Halpin, a prominent social scientist of Ohio State, Chicago, and Washington universities, stated in his book, Theory and Research in Administration, "This dilemma of definition emerges from the fact that we have incorporated into the term leadership both descriptive and evaluative components and have thus burdened this single word and the concept it represents with two connotations. One refers to a role and the behavior of a person in this role, and the other is an evaluation of the individual's performance in the role. We have compounded this confusion more by conceptualizing leadership as an essentially innate capacity of the individual manifested with equal facility regardless of the situation in which the leader finds himself. Yet Stogdale has shown that the trait approach to leadership, as it has been used in most studies reported in literature, has yielded negligible and often contradictory results." Sanford has aptly summarized this situation. "From all these studies of the leader, we could conclude with reasonable clarity that there are either no general leadership traits, or if they do exist, they are not to be described in any of our familiar psychological or common sense terms. And in a specific situation, leaders do have traits that set them apart from followers. But what traits set what leaders apart from what followers will vary from situation to situation." Halpin gives clear expression to the dominant attitude of the establishment in leadership studies today. When one recognizes this emphasis, there are several questions that immediately come to the forefront and to which attention must be given. Many of these will be developed in the remainder of this study. Leaders are not born, despite of the popular maxim, "Well, she's a natural born leader." A doctor in the delivery room doesn't hold up a newborn infant and exclaim, "Well, looky here, we've got ourselves a natural-born leader." Local paper doesn't report the birth of a 7-pound, 6-ounce leader yesterday at 2:30 in the afternoon. The skills of leadership can be learned through experience. If indeed leadership is not some kind of an innate trait which some people are born with and some people are not, but rather it's a series of services which a member of a group performs for and in that group, the traditional concepts of leadership need to be re-examined. Traditional authoritarianism needs to be replaced by moving towards shared leadership, which encourages member participation and responsibility. Such leadership consists of coordinating efforts toward group goals rather than dominating group activities. If the leader acts as a boss, he plans, controls, directs, and decides. The group submits and conforms with some kind of passive assent. On the other hand, when the leader acts as a guide, he seeks to allow and to encourage the group to plan, control, direct, and decide. A guide is one who leads or directs along in any path or direction, showing the way by accompanying or going in advance. To be this kind of leader involves time, teaching, training, and trust. The goal becomes to mature your people. Most of the trait research today has focused on the motivational and managerial skills that can be developed, whereas earlier studies in this century focused on moral personality traits and general intelligence. For the last quarter century, researchers have used much directive observation, such as observational diaries and interviews, to collect data on what managers and leaders do and how they actually spend their time. Some of the major findings of modern research includes the following. Number one, managers and leaders work long hours. Many work at least 50 hours per week and often take work home with them. They find it difficult to forget about their jobs when they're at home or on vacation. Number two, leadership and management activities are many and varied during a typical workday. Research has shown that a manager will spend an average of 9 minutes on each activity. Number three, managers and leaders spend time on problems and the development of plans to deal with them. Number four, managers and leaders spend little time in reflective planning because they're so busy with the present. The large blocks of time necessary for thought and concentration are usually not available to them. They are dealing with immediate operational concerns. Number five, managers and leaders are involved with numerous people each day. There is much personal contact. This involves superiors, equals, subordinates, and those outside of the organization, such as clients or suppliers. This face-to-face contact gives the managers current information that aids them in decision-making. Number six, managers are involved in the planning process in an informal and adaptive way. Mintzberg, in a 1973 research study, divided managerial roles into three basic units, each with subunits. And based upon these various research studies by Mintzberg, the previous six items were developed by Mintzberg, which we have shared. But his first unit in this 1973 research study, his first unit he entitled Interpersonal Managerial Roles. The subunits included in this area of interpersonal managerial roles were the following. First, the manager is a leader. A leader makes the unit function to achieve organizational goals. This involves guidance, motivation, providing favorable work atmosphere and conditions. The leader would also hire, train, supervise, and terminate when needed. As manager, he is responsible. The second subunit under the interpersonal managerial roles, the manager is a liaison. He seeks to establish relationships outside of the organization. He will make new contacts. He will keep in touch with clients and our customers and suppliers. He will do many things involved with public relations. Number three, as a subunit, the manager is a figurehead. In this role, he will perform certain symbolic duties of a legal or social nature. He may sign certain documents, preside at certain meetings, ceremonies, and special events. He may receive official visitors to the organization. So, Mintzberg's first unit was entitled the Interpersonal Managerial Roles. In this, he said the manager is a leader, the manager is a liaison, and the manager is a figurehead. Mintzberg's second unit he entitled Informational Processing Managerial Roles. The subunits which Mintzberg included in this area are, number one, the manager is a monitor. He will seek information from many sources, from reading, attending meetings and seminars, observation, interviews, and so forth. Some of this information is passed on to supervisors or even outsiders. He evaluates this information to determine how helpful this information is to the organization and the fulfilling of its mission. The second subunit is the manager is a disseminator. As a manager, he often has the information first. Information that is not readily available to others within the group. Now, some of this information is for his eyes only. Some of this information is to be passed on to others. Some of this information may become a part of the policy or procedure of the organization. The point is that as manager, he has information power. He has information that no one else has. Knowledge is power. It's for this reason that history shows that ruthless leaders want to keep information away from the people. If people are kept in the darkness of ignorance, they are less likely to revolt against a ruthless leader. For that reason, communist border guards for years were ordered to confiscate current magazines and newspapers from Western tourists. The guards looked for weapons, books, magazines, and Bibles. They knew that if the truth got into the hands of the citizens, the task of maintaining tyranny would become more difficult. The manager must be a disseminator of truth rather than a hoarder of truth. There is a third subunit in this second area of Mintzberg's study, the informational processing managerial roles. And the third subunit is just this. The manager is a spokesperson. He will transmit information and value statements to those outside, also to superiors and, in addition, to subordinates. He is involved in a reporting system in these areas. He is a public relations representative. It is of the utmost importance, therefore, that the manager have up-to-the-minute information and knowledge of the organization. Mintzberg's third unit he entitled Decision-Making Managerial Roles. The subunits here include, number one, the manager is an entrepreneur. He is a facilitator of change to improve the organization. Some of these changes he will supervise directly, and some he will certainly delegate to others. The manager is like a juggler who has several balls in the air at the same time. From time to time, the ball comes into contact with the juggler, who gives it a burst of energy and sends it skyward again. This the manager does with projects, procedures, and changes. The second subunit in this area of decision-making managerial role would be this. The manager is a disturbance handler. He deals with sudden crises that cannot be ignored. He moves into the problem situation for the purpose of solution, and from this solution, he seeks new opportunities to enhance the work or, if you please, give the ball a sudden burst of energy. We might use our former illustration of the juggler. Now, this is important, for the other managerial roles are hindered until the conflict or disturbance or problem finds solution. This has to do with the welfare of both the worker and the organization as well. The third subunit in this area is developed by Mintzberg, this decision-making managerial role. The third unit is this. The manager is a resource allocator. He's involved with money, personnel, equipment, supplies, with purchases, and so forth. This has to do with budgets. It has to do with schedules, with time management, purchase orders, personnel evaluations. This certainly involves the manager in the process of strategic formation and strategy formation. He is in control of how personnel and resources are used. The fourth subunit, as developed by Mintzberg, the manager is a negotiator. He is involved in contacts with employees and suppliers and union workers if that is involved. So Mintzberg's study have certainly added in our understanding of managerial roles and managerial responsibility, as he has given us some of the major findings as we listed those six things a moment ago. At this point in our discussion, we want to consider a second major way in which leadership has been studied. We have noticed, as mentioned earlier, what we identified as the trait approach. Now we want to turn our attention to what has been called the behavioral approach to leadership study. One major study using this approach was the 1948 Michigan University Studies on Management and Leadership. These studies stated that different managerial behavior could be expressed in one of two different ways. Bartle and Martin, in their book entitled Management, identify these as follows. Number one, job-centered behavior. The manager was interested in the performance and the completion of the task. His concern was getting the job done. This was at the forefront of his planning and implementing. The most important thing was the task to be completed. And then Bartle and Martin in their book Management mentioned a second item that came out of this 1948 University of Michigan study, and that is not only job-centered behavior, but employee-centered behavior. The manager wanted to develop a cohesive work group and to be sure that employees were basically satisfied with their jobs. The manager wanted happy, contented employees doing the task for which the organization was in existence. Also, in 1948, Ohio State University developed leadership and management studies which reflected two types of managerial behavior. Again, these are summarized by Bartle and Martin in their book Management. First, there is consideration behavior. The manager was concerned about the feelings of subordinates and showed respect for subordinates' ideas and concepts. The emphasis was on mutual respect, trust, and two-way communication. The second type of managerial behavior that was noted was initiating structure behavior. In this managerial style, the leader would clearly define subordinate roles, establish channels of communication, establish methods for accomplishing group tasks. In this approach, there would be a great deal of control from the top.